Grief is a natural part of life, and we all experience it at some point. By becoming aware of our emotions in the process of grief, we can begin to accept and move through our pain. Acceptance doesn't mean that we forget or stop feeling the loss, but it allows us to come to terms with it. And finally, we can choose to honour our loved ones by celebrating their life and finding meaning in our grief. Join me as we explore these pillars of grief and how they can help us navigate the journey of grief. We will explore this journey together, and you will hear from experiencers, experts, and researchers. I'm Jock Brokas, and this is The Pillars of Grief.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jock here, and this is The Pillars of Grief. Today, I've got a very special guest that I'm going to bring on. We're going to talk a little bit about her journey from researcher, someone who was maybe a little bit skeptical of the afterlife or carrying consciousness forward after death of the physical body. We're going to talk to her because it's great to also, you know, for have me coming on board, talking to you from my experiences as a medium. There's a lot of people out there that don't necessarily believe in the afterlife, or they have difficulty trying to bring this into their life and this understanding. So I think it's very beneficial for those of you out there to understand the journey that you may be on. If you may have lost someone recently or even a while ago and you're still suffering, grief is no timeline. And grief is, you've heard me many times talk about, it's not something that you heal from, it's something that you integrate into your life. And just recently, as you'll hear from the last podcast I did about a week ago, we just lost a very, very dear friend to us. So your grief can be your greatest teacher or it's your greatest nemesis. But it depends on how you embrace the journey. So welcome today, Laurel Waterman, who's a colleague of mine at Aleph Trust, actually one of my tutors. And when we were on a webinar, she mentioned something. Of course, my ears pricked up and I was like, ah, I must bring her on.
Are you struggling with grief? Hi, I'm Jock Brokas, a grief researcher, author, spiritual mentor, and renowned evidential medium. Join me on the Pillars of Grief podcast. Through personal teachings and interviews with experienced researchers and educators, I will provide valuable insights and support to help you navigate your journey through grief. I will answer the questions you yearn to be answered, and I'll help you understand your journey. Listen and subscribe to the Pillars of Grief podcast today on your favorite platform and start navigating your journey through grief.
So we're going to talk to Laurel about her journey and her understanding of grief. Laurel, welcome to Pillars of Grief.
Thank you so much, Jack.
It's great to have you on here. Now, you are a researcher at the University of Toronto, and you have different, you're heavily involved in education, but let's talk a little bit about you and your journey. Maybe, you know, before we get to this kind of transformation that happened to you, I don't want to say happened for you. I don't like the word to you, but happened for you. And what you've gone, you know, what you've gone through. Talk us a little bit about you growing up, your life. Maybe if you had a materialist stance, or you know how you understood the world operated, and then we'll kind of move on from there.
Okay, thanks. So I grew up in Toronto, in Canada, and I was born in the 80s. So. I'm a very reformed Jew. So religion was in my life as a cultural tradition, but I never believed in any of it. And I suppose I never imagined that anything about spirituality could be true in the sense of like consciousness beyond this material form. I never believed there could be a God. Or I respected other people's spiritual traditions. I thought they were fascinating. I even felt called to go to India when I was 19 on a spiritual quest. And I did meditation and yoga and all this stuff. But my understanding of spirituality was about finding peace in this life. It was about relationships with others. It was about love, but it was all about this singular life because I thought that it was proven by science that that's all that there is. And it never occurred to me to question it until I experienced a profound loss.
Now that seems obviously coming from the background that you came from in your family, from having a Jewish upbringing or, you know, which is very kind of dogmatic in any religion is kind of has a lot of dogma attached to it. What made you then seek more of a peaceful side of things and fall away from that pattern or belief system?
You mean the sort of trip to India?
Yeah, what made you take that on board? Because even when you were younger and you were kind of brought up in a Jewish, you know, the Jewish faith and Judaism, what was it inside of you that was yearning for more? Because obviously you said you didn't fall into that structure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that the way I learned about Judaism, it wasn't spiritual. I learned about the religious aspects, the cultural, the ritual, but it wasn't about a connection with anything beyond. And I guess what drew me to go to India was I was really miserable in my life for no good reason. When I was about 19 years old, I was suffering from a long-standing eating disorder. I was very insecure. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I felt just depressed, stuck. And I was frustrated with those feelings because I thought, wow, this is probably one of the best times and places in history to be a woman in Canada. And, you know, the 1990s, like I could do anything. I was, you know, had means to go to university. I was there. This is what I'd been dreaming of. And I found myself completely depressed. And I thought, I need some perspective here, especially with the eating disorder stuff. And I just felt, actually what happened was I had a conversation with myself. Are you familiar with the book, Conversations with God?
Oh God, yeah, Neil Donald Walsh. Yes.
Yeah, so I read that because my mom actually taught sociology at a college, and
right.
She did some teaching on parapsychology and death and dying to nurses.
Oh, wow.
And so she had this book in our house, and I read that book, and it was like that. It was like I was in bed, depressed, skipping a psychology class, actually. And I asked myself, like, why, Laurel, why are you so depressed? Like, what is this about? What is the problem here? And I got an answer. And the answer was, I'm afraid. And I said, well, what am I afraid of? And the answer was, I'm afraid of being fat. And I said, why are you afraid of that? And the answer was, because I'm afraid if I'm fat, people will think I'm ugly and they won't like me and I'll be alone. And I sort of drilled it down to a fear of being alone. And I thought, well, what's so scary about being alone then? And suddenly I had the idea to go to India.
Wow.
Alone. And then I wouldn't have to be afraid of being alone anymore.
Wow. And so then you went to India. And did you still find yourself alone when you were there? Or did you make...
Yeah, what I would say is it changed my understanding of loneliness.
Right, okay.
That loneliness is not necessarily about being alone.
Right.
You can be with a lot of people and still feel lonely. You can be alone and not feel lonely.
Yeah.
Loneliness is a relationship with yourself in a particular context.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of people don't understand that. Actually, it's the worst. It's one of the worst things to go through is to feel lonely in yourself. Because at one point in my life, I was the same. And it's, you kind of grow through that and understand that you're not alone. And it's a true saying, you can be in a party and be the loneliest person in the room. Just trying to understand that. So did you find, you went on almost like a pilgrimage Do you think you found, did you find your partner there? Did you find yourself there? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say I found myself.
Right.
It changed me. It changed my relationship with food, with my own body. I mean, it planted the seeds, and then it was a longer process of kind of change and reinforcement. And I discovered vegetarianism, which led to veganism eventually. I discovered yoga. But what's funny is that all of it was still materialist for me.
I was going to say to you there, where did you even consider anything beyond, because everything you're talking about is still kind of within the construct of the material world. Where did it change for you to, I mean, we're going to go into that, but did you consider anything about there's got to be something greater than this?
I can tell you the story of the first time ever I sat to meditate.
Yeah,
I was at a juice stand in Varkala, India, which is in southern India in Karnataka. And I saw a flyer, like a little pamphlet for the Shivananda Yoga Ashram. And I read it, and on the back, it had instructions of how to meditate. So I thought, oh, I'll try this. So I went back to my guest house, and there was this cliff, and I sat kind of close to the edge of the cliff and closed my eyes and followed the instructions, which were just to close your eyes and focus on your breathing and relax and all that. And suddenly, like snap, my mind went into this different place that was kind of this blank, white, calm sort of space. And it was neat. I was like, whoa, that's what meditation is. That is so cool. Thinking that that's what would happen every single time someone sat down to meditate.
Delusions of grandeur right there.
Because it happened to me the first time. And then I told another traveler and they said, oh, beginner's luck. And sure enough, that never happened again until decades later, I had another experience. But I guess that was interesting, but I thought it was maybe a place in my mind that I had accessed. Yeah, I was still very much in the materialist.
I was going to say that you were still in the material construct. You were still, you know, stuck in that. So did you think then that the experience was coming from your brain?
Yeah, I guess so.
Right.
I never thought to question it. I didn't think there was any possibility that there was consciousness beyond the brain. I thought it was case closed. Science had proven it. I don't know how I thought that, but it's what I picked up.
But this is going to change, and it changes. So how long? So did you then come back from India? Did you meet your partner out there? How did that happen to your change and move on to meeting your loved one?
Yeah, it was many years later, maybe 8 years later, that I met my partner. We met at a dog park. Our dogs started playing, and I mean, that was an amazing experience because, I mean, now I look back and go, there was something more there, that sudden kind of looking at him and that spark. But at the time I just thought, oh, wow. And it just clicked. And we were very quick to know that each other was the one, and moved in, started our family, et cetera.
Now, before we go into your loss, and we won't go deep into it because I know it can be quite an emotional thing, but how was your partner in terms of was he quite a materialist, or, you know, or did he believe in anything beyond the grave?
Not so much, like not in a conscious way that he would express. But looking back on some of his attitudes towards things and his approach to life, I think that maybe he was at a different stage of this journey, this sort of soul journey, if you will. I think he was maybe a little further along in some ways, because he wasn't afraid. He had no fear. And I have a lot of fear. And he would just say, oh, I'm not afraid of death. I think it's just a nice rest. That's how he would speak about it.
So you still have an inherent fear of death?
I don't think I have so much of a fear of death anymore, but I still have a fear of loss because of how painful it is. And so my fear of death is more around the attachment to the people who are here than it is about what's going to happen to me when I die, because now I really, I'd say 99%, I'm sure that it's not just like nothingness, darkness, extinguished everything when you die.
So you had, how long were you together with your husband?
8 years almost.
8 years. And then obviously tragedy struck.
Yeah. So sudden accidental death. I was 36. He was 41 years old. We had three kids. So my stepdaughter was 9, and then our two kids together were 6 and 4.
Now, were you at university at the time? Were you studying, or you'd already had done all your...
No, I have a master's in adult education and in narrative research, and I was teaching creative nonfiction writing for many years at the University of Toronto.
Without going into too much details of the loss of your husband, when did that change for you? Because let's talk a little bit, if you want to, let's talk a little bit about your loss, because a lot of people that listen to this are suffering through loss. What happened, and how did that make you feel?
Well, I mean, anyone who's gone through loss, and maybe particularly like a shocking loss, an unexpected tragic loss, it's hard to articulate the feelings. It's just such a the whole ground is gone. Like the ground that you stand on is just suddenly gone. And you're just falling through time. And that was, I mean, it was terrible. I am very grateful that I have a lot of friends and family who supported me. And that's it. I mean, I only am here because they kind of all reached out and grabbed me.
That's amazing that you had, you had that support, because many people don't. And I think a lot of the time is... some people, they do have a lot of support, but the people that are supporting you don't understand the journey and therefore don't know how to cope with it themselves. And there's an aspect to that. But if that's, you know, if you had great support and it helped you through that, I think that's something that's massive in somebody's life. So you never, now let me ask you then, I'm just going to be direct. Did you believe in an afterlife, or the consciousness existing after the death of the physical body?
No, I mean, that's the materialist paradigm, is no, there's no room for that possibility. And what I found as my grief progressed is I realized that that was causing me additional pain. So on top of the loss and the coping and having to continue on in life, that belief that my love was just, you know, he was just gone, just didn't exist at all, it caused me so, so much despair, more than I ever would have imagined before this had happened. And that is the piece that led me to suspend my assumptions just for a moment. And actually, it wasn't even conscious. What happened is a friend of, his name was Aaron, my partner. And so a friend of his sent me some books on grief and death. And one of those books was The Light Between Us by the medium Laura Lynn Jackson. Have you read that one?
Yes, yes, yes. I know of Laura's work.
Because all I could do really, other than survive, was read and write. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't go out with people. I could read and I could write in my journal. And that was kind of it. That was how I coped. And so I read this book, and that was the first time, like, I'd really never heard much about mediums. That I didn't even know what the word really meant. That's how absent it is from our education and culture. So pushed to the fringe. It was a big
no-no, yeah.
Yeah. When I read this book, that was the first time I heard about the Windbridge. Is it the Windbridge?
Windbridge Institute. Yeah. The research that they do in consciousness.
And the quadruple blinded studies with mediums. And I thought, you know, in her narrative that she provides in that book, it's so earnest. It's so detailed. I thought, why would she be making all this up? How could she be making all this up? But then finding out about that research made me think, huh, is there actually, could there actually be something to this? Like, is there a way that people could actually have access with deceased people?
Let me ask you, because obviously you're now kind of changing. Your materialist assumption has been challenged. But before it was challenged by the book that you read, The Light Between Us, between Laura's work or anything else, was there anything in you that gave you a sense of there could be something beyond? Like any feeling, or was there anything weird, I would say, for want of a better expression, that maybe you experienced that was like, huh, that's not normally scientific?
Not really. I mean, are you talking about any kind of psi or communication stuff? Like, I don't think
so. Look, so for example, my brother, when I lost my father, my brother is not afterlife oriented or minded, but he had an experience that made him, and to say, I mean, I couldn't say that he was 100% even now, you know, but he had an experience where he felt the touch of my father, and something weird happened to him. So many people, you know, that don't believe or don't have any, you know, have some kind of experience, whether it's a dream, whether it's something that happens in the physical world where, you know, the electricity is played with or something happens like that. So, you know, oftentimes our loved ones will then kind of try and wake you up by giving you little signs. So I'm wondering, did you experience anything like that at all, or were you totally, no?
No, I had some dreams, a couple of dreams that now I would say are visitation dreams. But at the time, I just thought they were dreams. And again, in the materialist paradigm, dreams are just, you know, your brain firing stuff. I had a visualization of Aaron very clearly a few months after he died while I was out dancing. And he looked younger. He looked so, you know, slimmer. He was wearing this perfectly white shirt. He just looked kind of angelic, like him. And it was very vivid. So it was unusual. But again, you know, I thought, I'm just imagining this.
Of course.
Right.
And when did you get to the point where you're not imagining it? What took you forward in that journey then? Because now you're getting to the point where your whole world is rocked, but also your whole world's just about to be challenged and turned upside down, and your material paradigm is going to fall through the floor. So what got you to that point?
Mm-hmm. So there are a few different stories, because each one I found, anytime something abnormal or something you can't explain happens, when you're a strident materialist, it's an anomaly, right? And you sort of can put it aside and go, okay, that was really weird and I can't explain it, but I'll just continue along. So it took a few different things. But the first one, after reading the Laura Lynn Jackson book, I thought maybe I should talk to a medium. And I spoke to a few mediums. Well, I spoke to one and it seemed kind of amazing at the time. And then afterwards, I listened to the recording and she was doing a little bit of fishing and I was giving her information. And so I thought, oh, she's just a fraud. And that made me feel even worse. But then another medium was recommended to me by a friend, a trance medium. So I didn't even know what that meant, but I booked an appointment with this person and went and saw him. His name is Bart Smit, and he channels a person called Dr. Willems. And the whole thing seemed completely ridiculous while I was in it. He, you know, pretended to fall asleep with this elaborate snoring and then woke up as a different person with a thick Scottish accent. And I just felt like such an idiot even being there. And he asked me to say Aaron's name 3 times. And then we had a conversation. And so, I mean, he was saying some interesting things, But then he said something that was amazing to me. So Aaron died while he was on a trip in Vancouver, Canada, and I'm in Toronto, so across the country. And he said, he's saying something that he should have called Barry. Did he know anyone named Barry? And I, like, in Vancouver. And I didn't, it didn't ring any bells. I didn't think of anyone named Barry. I said, no. He said, okay, well, he's saying he should have called Barry. So just take that. So I said, okay. And the session ended. And later that night, while I was lying in bed, I sat up in bed because I suddenly remembered that Aaron had a friend in who lived in Vancouver named Barry. He was sort of a work colleague, but they would hang out whenever they were in the same place. And so he did have a friend in Vancouver named Barry who he would call in that situation, that he said, I should have called him. And to me, that was totally beyond chance. I mean, Barry's not that common a name. It's in a different city. There's no way you could look that up, that they're connected, and like pick that out. I mean, it couldn't have been fraud. It couldn't have been chance. So what? He didn't read my mind because Barry wasn't even anywhere in my mind. So how did that happen? And so that was and remains inexplicable to me, that particular little detail that came out of that meeting with that.
Wow. Medium. Was that the catalyst for you then to begin researching beyond the material construct and researching now that consciousness survives?
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, it was part of the journey. I had already started reading about consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I guess another turning point was when my grief therapist at the time gifted me a book, because he was a co-author on it. And maybe you're familiar with the book Irreducible Mind.
Oh, yes.
Which is, so he's, this was Adam Crabtree.
Right, yes.
Who happened to be my therapist.
Wow, and okay.
I was explaining to him, oh, I just really want to believe that Aaron's still around and yeah, there's something beyond this life. And he said, oh, well, I believe there is. Here, have this book.
Wow.
Which, for people who haven't read it, it's very dense psychological text, but it takes William James and Frederick Myers' work from the last century and
two of my favorites,
all of the data and research that really supports their view of consciousness survival or their sort of hypothesis. So anyway, it's a big, long, tough read, but I think it's very hard to read that book and still remain an unquestioning materialist.
Beyond this podcast, my work involves delivering thought-provoking talks and workshops which are deeply rooted in my experience and extensive research. My objective is to bring a profound understanding of grief to your organization, turn an adversity into strength, resilience, and growth. I can help you forge a compassionate and supportive environment that encourages emotional resilience. We will create sustainable solutions for managing grief and loss. Understanding grief isn't a luxury, it's a necessity, a fundamental aspect of our human experience that directly impacts our work lives. As leaders, your comprehension and management of grief can be transformational for your organization. I invite you to collaborate with me on this journey. Contact me at jockbrokers.com.
Did you, after that experience, did you start to have more experiences of communication from the other side or phenomena that would happen in or around about you?
Yeah, so I'd say another amazing part of that transformative journey was an experience of synchronicity. And I actually just wrote about this for an article that's going to be in a collection on synchronicity. But I can tell the story here, and it's, so it was about 6 months after Aaron died. I guess that medium was more like 3 months after Aaron died. So this was a little bit later. It was winter here, very cold. My kids had just been accepted into a children's grief counseling program.
Wow.
Through a nonprofit here in the city. And it was a Thursday night. It was our intake appointment. So that's really hard. I mean, to take your kids to a children's grief center. Wow. So I was just grieving so deeply that evening. And the kids went in with an art therapist, a children's art therapist. And I sat with another therapist, she was checking in on how I was doing. And I was weeping, and it was just, I was really in the depth of it. Mm. And I said to her in that session, like, I just wish I knew, like, beyond any doubt, that Aaron is still around, you know, and that I'll see him again one day and that he can see us. And I feel like if I knew that, I could continue on, like I could find the strength, you know, to recover from this. And she said, well, why can't you believe it? Nobody knows. And I said, I don't know why I can't believe it, but I just can't. I need proof. Doesn't have to be scientific, but like proof for me.
And this is after you've had the communications readings and things.
That's right. But one thing I found, and maybe I'm just particularly stubborn, but the tracks in my brain, the materialist tracks, run so deep that it's like that, oh, that was really weird, but I couldn't integrate it into an actual shift.
Right. In ontology. And you're always looking to add it up. Well, how could they have known this? Well, there could be super PSI, super consciousness. And exactly.
Exactly.
And then you try to find a material solution.
Yeah, because it's so threatening, actually, to have your whole worldview shift.
Oh, God, in your middle. Absolutely.
Yeah. When you're 37 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
So I drove home. You know, I was crying. I was just so sad. And it was freezing cold, like minus 30 degrees Celsius, February night. And my daughter, my four-year-old, fell asleep on the way home. It was after bedtime by the time we got home. So I let my six-year-old into the house and I was walking back to the car to pick my sleeping four-year-old out of the car and carry her into bed. And as I was walking around to the car, I heard a coin fall. Somehow in the snow, I heard a coin fall and a thought entered my mind. And the thought was, what if that coin was from Aaron's birth year, which was 1976.
Wow.
Wouldn't that be proof? Okay, so that was the thought that I had in my mind. So because of that thought, I looked down to try and find this coin in the snow, which ordinarily, who cares? It's cold, it's late, it's dark, whatever. Who cares if a coin falls? But because of that thought, I looked down and I immediately saw a penny in the snow, and I picked it up and I looked at for the date, and it was dark and I was squinting and I couldn't believe it, but it was 1976. And as soon as I realized for sure that it said 1976, I felt this sense of calm and joy.
Beautiful.
And I heard not Aaron's voice, but like a thought in the form of a thought in my mind that said, here's your proof. I'm fine. Be happy.
Wow. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that's to have a gift like that. And it came from out of thin air. It just dropped.
Yeah. Well, it may have been in my pocket. I mean, it's possible that it fell out of my pocket. It was an American penny. And I had
How could it fall out your pocket? Where did it land? This is the materialist researcher, and you say, how could it fall out of my pocket?
I mean, even if I did have the coin in my possession before, and even if it did happen to fall out of my pocket at that moment,
the fact that it was 1976.
To me, the combination of the thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where did that thought come from?
Yeah.
Right? In that moment, not an hour after I had been saying, I just need proof to go on. And then that thought and the finding it and the fact, like 1976, I haven't found a coin from 1976 since.
Have you still got that coin? My goodness. Right, that's brilliant.
So
I love that.
All right, that's upside down.
I love that. Yeah, that's in a port. I'm going to go for the fact that that's in a port.
Yeah, so I mean, I still have trouble wrapping my head around the a port thing.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, and it's similar. Like, I still have trouble accepting the physical mediumship stuff because I've never seen it. It's not that I don't trust the people who are reporting it. It's just personal direct experience is so important when it comes to shifting a worldview.
Yeah, that's why. And you've heard me in the talks we've had at LF where I've said, you know, experience trumps theory every time. And I still maintain that once you've had that experience. And there's a lot of, I mean, physical mediumship is not like it used to be back in the day. Back in the day, it was beyond what you could experience here. Full materializations. I'm actually one of the heads, the president of the Helen Duncan Foundation. I've been trying to work with the family to clear her name for, if you don't know anything about Helen Duncan, I'll send you some information. Helen Duncan, that case history was during World War II when she was actually having a seance and a full materialization of a sailor materialized in front of everybody with witnesses, gave information that British intelligence didn't even know that a German had just sunk one of the ships off the coast of Britain, and it kind of broke the Official Secrets Act, and there was all a whole hoodoos. There's been shows, TV programs, all sorts going on. In fact, if you look behind my desk, I actually have her trumpet from that day. So,
oh wow, oh my gosh.
So I've been heavily involved in that side of things, and I have witnessed materialization phenomena and various other types of phenomena. And it's very hard to take it on, especially if you have a material outlook. I've been heavily involved in that, and it's very difficult to take on that idea or that phenomena if you have never experienced it. But it does throw your world upside down. But I do believe, I mean, I don't like to use the term believe. I do know that apports can happen. I've actually got one sitting on my desk at the moment that was apported to me from a very long way away. So I do believe, I know that that coin was apported for you as a gift, and I'm glad that you got it around your wrist, because it's certainly a stark reminder, maybe every time you feel it or every time you think about it, and that, you know, that exists. And I think you still have to remain scientific. Like, I'm still very scientific, and I'm very careful when people say they had feathers from angels and you know, walking down the street and they get a feather and every New Ager thinks that, and you know, that's just not true, because probably it just dropped from a bird above. But when there is, I once actually gave a sit-in to a woman. She came to see me in Florida. She drove from South Florida up to see me. I told her her daughter was going to call her. Or said that she'd been trying to call her. And I kind of thought it was, you know, during the time, you know, before she had passed over. On her way home, back to, I think it was Miami or down that way when she was driving back, the phone went. It was from her daughter's phone with that number. And she never had, nobody else had that phone. She had that phone, and it rang her from her number. She couldn't believe it. So I'm very well aware that they can manipulate things in the material world so that we can feel their presence. But you definitely have to remain very scientific about it. But there comes a time, and I suppose this is where I'm kind of the segue, where when then did you think, okay, or no, that your materialist beliefs were crumbling before you? When did you get to that point where, okay, no, it's not the way that they think it is or they perceive it is in the material world?
Yeah, so there's one more story that I think is really that moment. And it was at a past life regression retreat with Dr. Brian Weiss.
Okay.
At the Omega Center in New York. And I mean, even the story of me getting there is sort of interesting synchronicity, but I'll leave that because it's really about the experience. And it actually didn't have anything to do with past lives. But we did one exercise called a psychometry exercise. And I had never heard of what that was. I didn't know. But he asked us to pair up with somebody we did not know and exchange an object that you've owned for, I think, more than a month or a couple of months. So I gave my partner my earrings that I was wearing, and she gave me her cell phone. She didn't have anything else. But the cell phone, it was just face down in my lap. I didn't like look in her cell phone. It was just, I was holding her object. And Dr. Weiss led us into a relaxation and gave the instruction to just let whatever comes to mind that would be helpful for the owner of that object. Okay. And I don't know how long, maybe 10 minutes, just sat quietly. And I had, somewhat surprisingly, because I don't consider myself psychic or anything like that.
Right.
Nothing like that had ever happened to me before. But I had some scenes come into my mind, like into my mind's eye. So the first one, I saw her, and I didn't know this person at all, right? I just knew her name was Becco. She was a Chinese woman who had traveled from Seattle to come to this workshop in New York. That's all I knew about her.
Right.
So I closed my eyes and an image of her diving into an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Okay. Wearing a bathing cap, diving in. Okay. That. And then that kind of faded and was replaced by an image of her boarding a ship, a really large passenger ship.
Right.
And then that faded. And then I saw a very elderly Chinese man in a wheelchair. And then that scene kind of filled in around him.
Yeah.
Where I saw her sitting beside him.
Yeah.
Holding his hand. And I felt this incredibly powerful sense of gratitude from him towards her. And then I saw a young Chinese girl in a party dress, a red party dress, holding a birthday balloon. And I surmised that this was like a birthday party for this man, this elderly man. And it seemed sort of like a condominium almost. And then that scene faded. And I saw Becco, the woman, sitting on a deck overlooking the ocean, sipping a mug of tea. Okay, so all of that I saw in my mind's eye during that 10-minute relaxation thing. And so when he brought us out of it, he said, please tell your partner what you saw or what came to your mind. So I told Becco, and the swimming thing, I said, do you swim? She said, oh, sometimes. I said, oh, okay. This is all just, I don't know where this came from, just my imagination. But then I told her about the ship. And she said, was it a cruise ship? And I said, oh yeah, actually it was a cruise ship. And she said, oh my God, go on, go on. And then I told her about the elderly man and she goes, oh, my father. And she starts crying, bursts into tears. And so I told her the whole thing and she's just sobbing uncontrollably. And when she finally gets control of herself, she says, you are not going to believe this, but a month ago, I had a cruise booked to take my family to celebrate my father's 89th birthday. And he lives in China. And they were going to come from China to go on this cruise.
Wow.
But a couple of weeks before the cruise,
he passed.
My father, who was very healthy, suffered a stroke, a very serious stroke.
Yeah.
And he was in the hospital and the doctors were saying that he was most likely to die. He would never recover from this stroke.
Yeah.
So Becco told me that she flew to China, sat at his bedside and said to him, held his hand and said, Dad, I want to help you to recover, but I need to know that you want to recover. that you want to live. And somehow he communicated that to her, and she got a Reiki master to come and meet with him once and do healing with him. And against all the odds, he recovered to the point where he can speak, he can sit, he can use one arm, and he's in a wheelchair. And it was her greatest dream that she would be able to take him on this cruise to celebrate his next birthday, that he would be well enough. And she sort of interpreted this as a vision that that would come to be with the birthday celebration. And that. And I don't know about that. And I wish I kept in touch with her, actually.
I wish you'd have kept. That's brilliant.
To me, whether or not that ended up coming true is beside the point. How did that come to my mind? I knew nothing about this person. These really meaningful recent events in her life, her father's stroke, his healing, the booked cruise was canceled. I mean, they are so specific. The gratitude.
Very specific.
She had saved his life.
Do you know what you did? Right?
And it wasn't just general love. It was gratitude that he felt to her, which is different. And so to me, that was the experience that suddenly I realized how it could be possible to kind of connect to a greater sense of consciousness and experience that.
And I knew
there was no fraud involved.
No.
I didn't know her at all.
Yeah.
And this happened to me. So there's no doubt in my mind that it came from somewhere. It couldn't have been chance. It was too specific, too many things lined up.
I love it.
And I know I didn't know any of it before. So that was
And then it really all connected. Like all your experiences then start, you start to, wow. So you've had all the, you realize you've had more experiences than you actually thought.
Yeah. So that's kind of the experiential journey of how my ontology shifted from materialist to post-materialist, or I kind of prefer beyond the brain reality.
So obviously you've I don't know if you understood what you were actually doing, but what you were doing was is something called psychometry, and you're now post-material. What can you? I mean, I hate these labels because I know we talk about panpsychism and all the, you know, various different labels and. People have asked me, where do you fit? And I'm like, I don't know, because I'm a bit of that and a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of this. Where do you, you know, throwing you under the bus, where do you fit now with what you were to what you perceive you are now?
I'm not a materialist anymore. And one thing I like, there are some things I don't like about the term post-materialism. The thing I don't like about it is how actually I think we're just acknowledging what people have understood for millennia about reality that we've become disconnected to in this materialist time. So to call it post-materialism when it was there before seems awkward to me. But what I like about it is that it doesn't choose what that post-material understanding is per se. It's not saying, oh, I'm panpsychist or I'm an idealist or I'm whatever other designations there are. I actually don't know. I really don't know how it works.
I'm so glad you said that because I neither do I.
but what I find so profound is going from the certainty of knowing that materialism is how it works, that it's the material is the basis of reality, to not knowing that and knowing that there's something beyond that, for me is transformative enough. And that's what I'm trying to do with my focus in education and my research, is just to let people develop that awareness. Don't preclude that possibility through the ways that we teach science and the worldview that we teach.
Has that totally changed the way that you approach your education now, that your research and the work that you do now?
Well, the whole reason I went back to school to do a PhD was because of how much this shifted understanding about reality changed me. Like, it helped me with grief. It helps me with relationships. It helps me navigate life in a completely different way. It helps me with my work, with my stress, with my balance. Like, I now meditate in a different way. I check in with my intuition. I trust in synchronicity. I have experienced more love and positivity and just a sense of purpose in what I'm doing and the whole point of being here, which it's a game changer. I mean, and I think it's for the better. So that's why I work to shift this paradigm in our education, because I think it's a real injustice that we're bringing up kids with these materialist assumptions, not ever encouraging them to even question it. And then they're faced with inevitable grief in life, inevitable loss, the inevitable experience of death, their own and other people's. And it's a really different experience from a non-material perspective.
Have you had experiences then with your students where they have had difficulty on their grief journey and where you've been able to point them in the right direction or even plant seeds within them?
Well, I mean, I'm teaching a little bit like tutoring at the Aleph Trust, but my work teaching at University of Toronto is not yet in consciousness. I'm teaching creative writing, essentially. But I have had students who are connected to me through LinkedIn or have looked up my writing and they read it. And then they come to my office during office hours and they say, I read your work and it's validated these experiences that I've had that I haven't been able to think about or understand. And for them, it's the beginning of a path towards integration.
We'll need to get you back on maybe to talk about creative writing, because obviously as an author myself, there's a great deal of power in the pen. And I often teach that to people in my community, that to write and to creatively write is a pathway to that grief journey and to, you know, integrating that grief journey and integrating your understanding into that process. So I'd love to talk more about that as well. And before we finish, how important do you feel your experiences that led you to go from, I want to use the term, going from belief to knowing? For me, that's very different. I don't believe in anything. I try to get to a point of knowing, because if I believe in something, it kind of, it's, I'm believing in the perception of others or expectations of others. So how important was your journey into the survival of consciousness and you being able to integrate this into your life and then also help others like your students?
I can't overstate how transformative it's been. I mean, transformative. Like, it just, I've completely changed as a result my attitude towards everything around life and living. I mean, it's just
very difficult,
hard
to go
articulate,
back.
Actually. Yeah, but I'm just, I mean, I, you know, it's tricky because the reason I'm here is because of the absolute worst experience of my life, which was losing Aaron. And I remember when I was early on in the grief process and people would say things like, oh, you're going to change as a result of this. You know, something good will come out of it. I didn't even want to hear it. I didn't want anything good to come
platitudes
out of his death, right? Because it was just so terrible. And now I'm 5.5 years down the road. And, you know, I still don't want to say anything good came out of his death, but my whole life is completely different. And the work I do, the way I am with my kids, with my new partner, with all my friends, with spirit. I didn't believe in spirit, you know, and now I feel that there is something beyond this. There is a greater kindness. There is some kind of purpose. We are supposed to learn from these things.
Do you think it became your greatest teacher?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's something I maintain all the time. Grief can be your greatest teacher or your greatest nemesis, and you have the choice. You have the choice to be able to do that.
Both. It could be both.
Laurel, I want to thank you for coming on the Pillars of Grief. You're sharing your story and the wisdom, what you've gone through, will certainly help many, many people who listen to this at some point. And if people are interested on your writing or how your creative work that you do within university, how can they check that out and check your work out?
I'm on LinkedIn.
Right.
I have to assemble a better hub. I don't have a website or anything, but the Aleph Trust, alephtrust.org, has my faculty page, which has some links to my work. And I'll be updating those as new ones come.
I'll link all that in the show notes. Is there any final thoughts you would like to leave to anybody out there who's perhaps was like you, had a material outlook, that didn't think anything existed beyond? What could you give them now or tell them if they've lost a loved one?
I think just let yourself be curious. You know, let yourself imagine even an unlikely possibility beyond what you've been conditioned to believe. For me, even though the direct experiences were ultimately the most vital and transformative, I don't know that they would have been that if I hadn't been reading about consciousness studies research, about the kind of larger context to validate my own experience. So I think all of those are good approaches to getting through these really, really difficult times.
Thank you, Laurel. Thank you for sharing everything. It was great having you on. Ladies and gentlemen, you can take away, it doesn't matter what you believe now. Your experiences and your experience in life will make you who you are, but it can also teach you the greatest lessons of your life. What may seem to be negative could be your greatest teacher. Keep an open mind. Understand that we continue on. That death doesn't exist. It's a mere illusion. And you've heard me many times before say that we're just moving into the next room, or your loved ones are in the next room. Take some heart. Take some comfort for knowing that life exists beyond what we experience here. And life is all about experience, and life is for living. Thank you for joining us on the Pillars of Grief. I will be definitely bringing Laurel back again to maybe talk about more of this creative expression that can help you guys as well. Again, Laurel, thank you for sharing your wisdom with us today. It's been an absolute delight having you here, and I'm grateful for you sharing, and I'm sure it's going to touch many hearts and souls out there. So thank you, and God bless.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack, for the opportunity.
Thank you for tuning in to the Pillars of Grief with me. If you've found this podcast helpful, please consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Also, leaving a review can help others find the show and receive the guidance they need on their journey through grief. I appreciate your feedback and look forward to hearing from you all. Join my free online support community for those grieving and connect with others who understand what you're going through. I offer you a spiritual blessing and hope you will join me on the next episode. Till then, open your mind and allow the power of the divine to transform your grief to spiritual realization. God bless.